This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Elastic, Flexible Thinking in a Time of Change. This is the author, Leonard Mlodinow. Note, this audiobook comes with a PDF that we will refer to from time to time. Introduction. The Demands of Change. On July 6, 2016, Niantic, a 40-person startup company founded by ex-employees of Google's Geo division, launched Pokemon Go, an augmented reality game that employs a phone's camera to let people capture virtual creatures that appear on their screens as if they exist in the real world. Within 2 days, the app had been installed on more than 10% of all Android phones in the United States, and within 2 weeks, it had 30 million users. Soon iPhone owners were spending more time each day on Pokemon Go than on Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, or Twitter. Even more impressive, within days of the game's release, the words Pokemon Go drew more searches on Google than the word porn. If you're not a gamer, you might roll your eyes or shrug at all that, but in the business world, the events are hard to ignore. The game generated an astonishing $1.6 million in revenue each day from domestic Apple users alone. Just as important, it added $7.5 billion to Niantic's market value virtually overnight. And within a month, it had doubled the stock price of Nintendo, the company that owns the Pokemon trademark. In its first 6 months of existence, more than 600 million people downloaded the Pokemon Go app. Contrast that with some of the great successes of the early 2000s. Facebook launched in 2004, but didn't hit the 30 million user mark until 2007. The hugely popular World of Warcraft game, also released in 2004, took 6 years to climb to its peak of 12 million subscribers. What seemed like pedal-to-the-metal growth back then became, 10 years later, life in the slow lane. And though no one can predict what the next big new thing will be, most economists and sociologists expect that society will only continue to morph faster in the foreseeable future. But to focus only on the speed of Pokemon Go's ascent is to miss much of the point. The game's massive success might not have been predictable, but neither was it accidental. In creating the app, Niantic made a series of innovative and forward-thinking decisions concerning the use of technology, such as piggybacking on the GPS and camera capabilities of a cell phone, and leveraging cloud computing to power the app, which provided a built-in infrastructure and a capacity to scale. The game also took advantage, like nothing before it, of App Store economics, a business model that hadn't even been invented when World of Warcraft launched. In that now familiar approach, a game is given away free of charge and makes its money by selling add-ons and upgrades. Maintaining that revenue stream was another challenge. In the interactive entertainment industry, a game can start out popular and still have the shelf life of raw oysters. To avoid that fate, Niantic surprised many with a long campaign to aggressively update the app with meaningful features and content. As a result, a year after its launch, 65 million people were still playing the game each month, and revenues had reached $1.2 billion. Before Pokemon Go, the conventional wisdom was that people didn't want a game that required physical activity and real-world interaction. And so, despite all the innovation in Silicon Valley, the Pokemon Go developers were often admonished that gamers just want to sit and play. But the developers ignored that widely held assumption, and by leveraging existing technologies in a novel way, they changed the way game developers think. The flip side of the Pokemon Go story is that if your thinking is not deft, your company can quickly sink. Just look at BlackBerry, Blockbuster, Borders, Dell, Eastman Kodak, Encyclopedia Britannica, Sun Microsystems, Sears, or Yahoo. And they are just the tip of the iceberg. In 1958, the average lifespan of companies in the S&P 500 was 61 years. Today, it is about 20. We have to face analogous intellectual challenges in our daily lives. Today we consume, on average, a staggering 100,000 words of new information each day from various media. It's the equivalent of a 300-page book. That's compared with about 28,000 words a few decades ago. Due to innovative new products and technologies, and to that proliferation of information, accomplishing what was once a relatively straightforward task can now be a bewilderingly complex journey through a jungle of possibilities. Not long ago, if we wanted to take a trip, we'd check out a guidebook or two, get AAA maps, and call the airline and hotels. Or we talk to one of this country's 18,000 travel agents. Today, people use, on average, 26 websites when planning a vacation, and must weigh an avalanche of offers and alternatives, with prices that not only change as a function of when in the day you wish to travel, but also as a function of when you are looking. Simply finalizing the purchase once you've decided has become a kind of duel between business and customer, with each vying for the best deal from his or her vantage point. If you didn't need a vacation when you started planning one, you might by the time you are done. Today, as individuals, we have great power at our fingertips, but we must also routinely solve problems that we didn't have to face 10 or 20 years ago. For instance, once, while my wife and I were out of the country, my daughter Olivia, then 15, gave the house sitter the night off. Olivia then texted us, asking us if she could invite a few friends over. A few turned out to be 363, thanks to the instant invitations that can be communicated over cell phones on Instagram. As it turned out, she wasn't entirely to blame. It was an overzealous friend who posted it. But it's a calamity that wouldn't have been possible when her brothers were that age, just a handful of years earlier. In a society in which even basic functions are being transformed, the challenges can be daunting. Today, many of us must invent new structures for our personal lives that account for the fact that digital technology makes us constantly available to our employers. We must discover ways to dodge increasingly sophisticated attempts at cybercrime or identity theft. We have to manage ever-dwindling free time so that we can interact with family and friends, read, exercise, or just relax. We must learn to troubleshoot problems with home software, phones, and computers. Everywhere we turn, and every day, we are faced with circumstances and issues that would not have confronted us just a decade or two ago. Much has been written about that accelerating pace of change, and the globalization and rapid technological innovation that have fueled it. This book is about what is not so often discussed, the new demands and how we must think in order to thrive in this whirlwind era. For as rapid change transforms our business, professional, political, and personal environments, our success and happiness depend upon our coming to terms with it. There are certain talents that can help us, qualities of thought that have always been useful, but are now becoming essential. For example, the capacity to let go of comfortable ideas and become accustomed to ambiguity and contradiction. The capability to rise above conventional mindsets and to reframe the questions we ask. The ability to abandon our ingrained assumptions and open ourselves to new paradigms. The propensity to rely on imagination as much as on logic and to generate and integrate a wide variety of ideas. And the willingness to experiment and be tolerant of failure. That's a diverse bouquet of talents, but as psychologists and neuroscientists have elucidated the brain processes behind them, those talents have been revealed as different aspects of a coherent cognitive style. I call it elastic thinking. Elastic thinking is what endows us with the ability to solve novel problems and to overcome the neural and psychological barriers that can impede us from looking beyond the existing order. In the coming pages, we will examine the great strides scientists have recently made in understanding how our brains produce elastic thinking and how we can nurture it. In that large body of research, one quality stands out above all the others. Unlike analytical reasoning, elastic thinking arises from what scientists call bottom-up processes. A brain can do mental calculations the way a computer does, from the top down, with the brain's high-level executive structures dictating the approach. But, due to its unique architecture, a biological brain can also perform calculations from the bottom up. In the bottom-up mode of processing, individual neurons fire in complex fashion, without direction from an executive, and with valuable input from the brain's emotional centers, as we'll be discussing. That kind of processing is nonlinear and can produce ideas that seem far afield and that would not have arisen in the step-by-step progression of analytical thinking. Though no computer and few animals excel at elastic thinking, that ability is built into the human brain. That's why the creators of Pokemon Go were able to quiet the executive functions of their brains, look beyond the obvious, and explore entirely new avenues. The more we understand elastic thinking and the bottom-up mechanisms through which our mind produces it, the better we can all learn to harness it to face challenges in our personal lives and our work environments. The purpose of this book is to examine those mental processes, the psychological factors that affect them, and most important of all, the practical strategies that can help us master them. Rising above the nematode. Every animal has a toolbox for handling the circumstances of daily life, with some capacity to confront change. Take the lowly nematode or roundworm, C. elegans, one of the most primitive biological information processing systems we know. The nematode either solves its problems of existence by employing a neural network composed of a mere 302 neurons with only 5,000 chemical synapses between them, or it perishes. Perhaps the most critical challenge the nematode experiences arises when its environment runs out of the microbes it feeds on. Upon recognizing that circumstance, what does this biological computer do? It crawls into the gut of a slug, waiting to be pooped out the next day in a different location. Not a very glamorous life. To us, the plan may sound both brilliant and disgusting, but in the roundworm's world, it is neither, for the few hundred neurons in its nervous system are incapable of either complex problem-solving or sophisticated emotions. To hitchhike in slug excrement is not a desperate creation of the nematode's mind. It is an evolutionary response to deprivation that is hardwired into each individual because the depletion of food is an environmental circumstance that such organisms face regularly. Even among more complex animals, much of an organism's behavior is scripted, by which I mean it is pre-programmed or automatic, and initiated by some trigger in the environment. Consider the brooding goose with her sophisticated brain sitting on her nest. When she notices that an egg has fallen out, she fixates on the stray egg, raises herself, and extends her bill to gently roll the egg back into her nest. Those actions appear to be the product of a thoughtful and caring mother. But, like the nematodes, they are simply the product of a script. Scripted behavior is one of nature's shortcuts, a reliable coping mechanism that leads to results that are usually successful. It can be either innate or the result of habit, and it is often related to mating, nesting, and killing prey. But what is most important, while scripted behavior can be appropriate in routine situations, it produces a fixed response, and so it often fails in circumstances of novelty or change. Suppose, for example, that as the goose begins to extend her neck, the stray egg is removed. Will she adapt and abort her plan of action? No, she will continue as if the egg were still there. Like a mime, she will nudge the now imaginary egg back toward her nest. What's more, she can also be induced to perform her egg rolling on any roundish object, such as a beer can or a baseball. In the wisdom of evolution, it was apparently more efficient to endow the mother goose with an automatic behavior that is almost always appropriate than to leave the egg-saving action to some more complex but nuanced mental process. Humans follow scripts too. I believe that I give more thought to my actions than the average mother goose, though some who know me may disagree. Yet I found myself, when passing the snack cabinet, grabbing a handful of almonds without pondering whether, at that moment, I really wanted a snack. When my daughter asks if she can stay home from school because she feels a cold coming on, I may respond with an automatic no instead of taking the request seriously and asking for specifics. And I found myself, while driving to a familiar place, following my familiar route without making a conscious decision to do so. Scripts are useful shortcuts, but for most animals it would be difficult to survive employing pre-programmed scripts alone. After recognizing her prey from a distance, for example, a hunting female lion must carefully stalk her quarry. The environment, the conditions, and the actions of her prey can vary considerably. As a result, no fixed script inscribed in her nervous system will be adequate to meet the demands of finding food. Instead, the lion must have the ability to evaluate the situation in the context of a goal and to formulate a plan of action aimed at achieving that goal. It is for those situations in which scripted modes of information processing do not serve an individual well that evolution has provided the two other means through which we and other animals can calculate a response. One is rational/logical/analytical thought, which, for simplicity, I will simply call analytical thought, a step-by-step approach through which an organism moves from one related thought to another based on facts or reason. The other is elastic thinking. Different species possess these in differing degrees, but they are thought to be most developed in mammals, especially in primates, and among primates, especially in humans. Analytical thought is the form of reflection that has been most prized in modern society. Best suited to analyzing life's more straightforward issues, it is the kind of thinking we focus on in our schools. We quantify our ability in it through IQ tests and college entrance examinations, and we seek it in our employees. But although analytical thinking is powerful, like scripted processing, it proceeds in a linear fashion. Governed by our conscious mind, in analytical thinking, thoughts and ideas come in sequence, from A to B to C, each following its predecessor according to a fixed set of rules, the rules of logic, as might be executed on a computer. As a result, analytical reasoning, like scripted processing, often fails to meet the challenges of novelty and change. It is in meeting those challenges that elastic thinking excels. The process of elastic thought cannot be traced in an A to B to C fashion. Instead, proceeding largely in the unconscious, elastic thinking is a nonlinear mode of processing in which multiple threads of thought may be pursued in parallel. Conclusions are reached from the bottom up through the minute interactions of billions of network neurons in a process too complex to be detailed step by step. Lacking the strict top-down direction of analytical thought and being more emotion-driven, elastic thinking is tailored to integrating diverse information, solving riddles, and finding new approaches to challenging problems. It also allows the consideration of ideas that are unusual or even bizarre, fueling our creativity, which also requires analytical thinking so that we may understand and explore those new ideas. Our elastic thinking skills evolved hundreds of thousands of years ago so that we could beat the odds presented by living in the wild. We needed those skills because, as primates go, we aren't the toughest physical specimens. Our close relative, the bonobo, can jump twice as high. The chimpanzee has, pound for pound, twice the arm strength. A gorilla might find a sharp-angled boulder, have a seat, and survey its surroundings. Humans sit on posh chairs and wear glasses. And if it's the wrong chair, we complain about a backache. Our ancestors were no doubt tougher than we are today, but what saved us from extinction was our elastic thinking, which gave us the ability to overcome challenges through social cooperation and innovation. In the past 10,000 years, we humans have settled into societies that are somewhat protected from the dangers of the wild. Over those many millennia, we've turned our powers of elastic thinking toward improving or enhancing our everyday existence. Robins' nests don't have bathrooms and squirrels don't store their acorns in safes, but we humans live in an environment built almost entirely on our own imagination. We don't just live in generic huts. We have homes and apartments of all designs and sizes. And we decorate them with works of art. We don't just walk or run. We bicycle, drive cars, travel in boats, and fly in airplanes, not to mention scooting along on razors, segways, and hoverboards. Each of these modes of travel at one time did not exist. They were each, at conception, a never-before-imagined solution to some perceived problem, as were the eraser and paper clips on your desk, the shoes on your feet, and the toothbrush in your bathroom. Wherever we go, we swim among the products of the elastic human mind. But though elastic thinking is not a new talent for the human species, the demands of this moment in history have thrust it from background to foreground and made it a critical aptitude in even the routine matters of our everyday professional and personal lives. no longer the tool of people such as scientific problem solvers, inventors, and artists, a talent for elastic thinking is now an important factor in anyone's ability to thrive. Onward. Psychologists and neuroscientists are only now working out the science of elastic thinking. They have discovered that the brain function that produces bottom-up elastic thinking is quite different from that which generates top-down analytical thinking. That science rests on recent advances in the study of the brain that have recast our understanding of many of its unique and distinct neural networks. For example, in 2016, the NIH's Human Connectome Project, employing revolutionary new high-resolution imaging techniques and cutting-edge computer technology, showed that the brain has far more substructures than anyone had previously believed. One important structure, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, was discovered to actually consist of a dozen distinct smaller elements. In all, the project identified 97 new brain regions, differentiated by both structure and function. The lessons of the Connectome Project have opened new vistas and have been compared to the discovery in physics that atoms are made up of smaller particles, protons, neutrons, and electrons. In the chapters ahead, I will make use of such cutting-edge neuroscience and psychology to explore how elastic thinking arises in the brain. Once we understand these bottom-up thought processes, we will learn ways of implementing, manipulating, controlling, and nurturing them. Part one of Elastic is about how we must adapt our thinking to change and why our brains are good at it. In part two, I will examine how humans and other animals take in information and process it so that they can innovate to meet the challenges of novelty and change. Part three is about how the brain attacks problems and generates new ideas and solutions. And part four is about the barriers that can stand in the way of elastic thinking and how we can overcome them. Along the way, I will examine the psychological factors that are important in elastic thinking and how they manifest in our lives. These include personality traits such as neophilia, the degree of affinity for novelty, and schizotypy, a cluster of characteristics that include a tendency to have unusual ideas and magical beliefs. They also include abilities such as pattern recognition, idea generation, divergent thinking, being able to think of many diverse ideas, fluency, being able to quickly generate ideas, imagination, being able to conceive of what does not exist, and integrative thinking, the ability to hold in mind, balance, and reconcile diverse or opposing ideas. Research on the brain's role in these traits constitutes one of the hottest new directions in both psychology and neuroscience. How do our minds respond to the demands of novelty and change? How do we create new concepts and paradigms, and how can we cultivate that ability? What keeps us tied to the old ideas? How can we become flexible in the way we frame questions and issues? We are fortunate that today, the enormous mountain of new scientific knowledge about how the bottom-up mind works makes it possible to answer such questions. As I unpack the science of the bottom-up thought mechanisms behind elastic thinking, I hope to change the way you view your own thought processes and to provide insight into how we think and how we can think better so that we can succeed in a world in which an ability to adapt is more crucial than ever before. Part 1. Confronting Change. Chapter 1. The Joy of Change. The Peril and the Promise. In the early days of television, a program called The Twilight Zone had an episode in which a race of 9-foot-tall aliens called the Kanamits land on Earth. They speak an unknown language, but they are able, via telepathy, to address the United Nations, where they vow that their sole purpose in coming is to aid humanity. They give the humans a book in their language, and cryptographers soon decode the title as To Serve Man, but they can't make out the meaning of the text within. In time, with Kanamit technology, deserts are transformed into fertile green fields, and poverty and hunger disappear. Some lucky individuals are even allowed to volunteer for a trip to see the Kanamit planet, said to be a paradise. And then one of the cryptographers finally breaks the code. She reads to serve man, then races to the ship where her boss, a fellow named Michael Chambers, is on the steps leading up to the entrance, about to depart for the alien planet himself. "Don't get on," she yells to Chambers. "The book is a cookbook." A cookbook in which humans are the main ingredient. The cryptographer had discovered that the aliens were here to help us, but in the manner that farmers helped turkeys in the days before Thanksgiving. And apparently, having a sense of humor, it left us a book of the recipes they planned to use. Chambers tried to disembark, but there was one of those 9-foot-tall aliens beside him. Not wanting to lose a yummy tidbit for his human stew, the alien blocks Chambers' retreat. The obvious moral of the Kanemet story is that there's no such thing as a free lunch, unless you're the lunch. But it is also about the peril and the promise of novelty and change. When an animal ventures out into new territory, it could lead to the discovery of a food source, or to becoming one. A novelty-seeking organism might get injured exploring alien terrain or might face a predator, but an organism that avoids the unfamiliar at all costs might fail to discover sufficient food sources and starve. An unchanging environment offers those who have found a comfortable niche no urgent impetus to explore or innovate. But conditions do change, and animals have a better shot at survival if they have previously gathered information about new feeding sites, escape routes, hiding places, and so on. Biologists see that reflected in the varying character of species. For example, dogs like to explore new territory because they're descended from particularly daring wolves that ventured out looking for food around the campsites of ancient human nomads. And birds that live in a complex and changing habitat, such as the edge of a forest, tend to exhibit more exploratory behavior than those that live in less variable surroundings. Today, it is we humans who must adapt, for our physical, social, and intellectual environments are changing at an unparalleled pace. Scientific knowledge, for example, grows exponentially. That is, the number of published papers doubles at a fixed rate, just as money invested at a fixed interest rate does. In the case of global scientific output, the doubling occurs about every 9 years. That has been the case for a long time. But in the past, that growth was possible to assimilate, because if you don't start with much in the first place, doubling does not represent a large incremental increase. Today, however, the volume of our knowledge has exceeded an important milestone. Today, to double our knowledge each 9 years means to add new knowledge so fast that no human can keep up. In 2017, for example, there were more than 3 million new scientific papers. That rate of production isn't just greater than the practitioners in any given field can assimilate, it is greater than the journals can contain. As a result, in the decade between 2004 and 2014, publishers had to create more than 5,000 new scientific journals just to accommodate the overflow. In the professional world, due to an analogous expansion of knowledge, many major industries also now depend on a volume of expertise that no single person could ever master. Arcane topics, from electric transformers to fuel injection, to the chemistry of cosmetics and hair products, are each the subject of hundreds of books. And that doesn't include the proprietary knowledge held by the corporations in those businesses. The intricacies of, quote, fuzzy logic optimization of injection molding of liquid silicone rubber, unquote, may not interest you, but it's an important enough subject in today's world that Furman Z. Sillow wrote a 190-page book on it in 2005. The growth of social media and the internet is even more drastic. The number of websites, for example, has been doubling every 2 to 3 years. Social attitudes, too, are changing fast. Just compare the pace of the civil rights movement to the speed at which the campaign for gay rights has swept the developed world, again fueled by the young. There is peril and promise in every decision about whether or not to embrace novelty. But in the recent past, as the pace of change has quickened, the calculus governing the benefits of embracing novelty has been dramatically altered. Today's society bestows rewards as never before upon those who are comfortable with change, and it may punish those who are not. For what used to be the safe terrain of stability is now often a dangerous minefield of stagnation. Consider the history of the telephone. We use the phrase dial a number because telephone numbers used to be input by turning a number dial. A new technology, push-button dialing, was introduced by Bell Telephone in 1963. It was more convenient than the older system and offered the possibility of making menu choices in response to automated phone systems. But the technology was not a great investment, at least not in the short term, because people were slow to alter their habits and adopt it, preferring to stick to the comfortable phones of the past. Even 20 years after the touch-tone devices became available, the majority of customers still had the old rotary phones. It wasn't until the 1990s, 3 decades after the introduction of touch-tone phones, that the older type of telephone became a rarity. Contrast that with what happened when Apple in 2007 introduced the first practical touchscreen mobile phone, meant to replace the existing keypad or stylus phones. The Apple phones were immediately the rage, and within several years, the competing technologies virtually vanished. Unlike the prior age, in which adoption proceeded at a snail's pace, in 2007, people were not just ready but eager to change their habits and hungry for every new phone version and capability that emerged in the years that followed. In the mid-20th century, it took decades for people to change their simple habit of using a dial phone, while in the 21st century, it took very little time for people to make the transition to carrying around with them what is essentially an entire computer system. Companies like BlackBerry that didn't immediately adapt to the new technology were quickly marginalized. But adaptation soon became equally important for individuals to reach their potential and to thrive socially. The Candlemas episode of The Twilight Zone aired just a year before the introduction of the touch-tone phone. At the end of the episode, Chambers, now on the ship, turns to the camera and asks the viewers, "How about you? You still on Earth or on the ship with me?" The implication was that it could be deadly to go along with what is new or different. Today, when alien ideas land in your professional or social world, it's a better bet to take your chances, climb aboard the spaceship, and check them out. The Myth of Change Aversion. Would you have climbed aboard the Candlemas ship? A widespread myth in our culture holds that people are averse to novelty and change. Change is an issue that arises often in the world of work, and the academic business literature has much to say about it. "Employees tend to instinctively oppose change," proclaimed one article in the Harvard Business Review. "Why is change so hard?" asked another. But is change really that hard? If people are generally averse to change, psychologists must have missed it, because if you instead search the literature of research psychology, you'll find nary a mention of change aversion. The reason for this difference in perception is that while management endows change initiatives with names like restructuring, turnaround, and strategic shift, employees often see them as something else, layoffs. When change translates to the risk of losing one's job, or when what is novel is an increased workload, it's understandable that people react negatively. But that's not change aversion. It's unemployment aversion, or negative consequence aversion. An employee might bristle at being called into a superior's office to be told, in essence, "The corporation is striving to be more efficient, so you will be asked to do 10% more work for the same salary." But that same employee would delight at being told, "The corporation is striving to be less efficient, so you will be asked to do 10% less work for the same salary." That's two opposite reactions to the same degree of change. The latter request never happens, but if it did, those Harvard Business Review articles would be saying, "Employees tend to instinctively love change," and asking, "Why is change so easy?" To avoid change because it is negative, or requires work, or introduces the risk of either of those eventualities, is a rational and logical reaction. But as far as human nature goes, in the absence of negative consequences, our natural instinct is the opposite. We humans tend to be attracted to both novelty and change. That trait, called neophilia, is a trait that is written about in the literature of academic psychology. Indeed, along with reward dependence, harm avoidance, and persistence, neophilia is considered one of the four basic components of human temperament. An individual's general attitude toward novelty and change is affected by both nature and nurture, our genes and our environment. The influence of our environment is most apparent in the evolution of human attitudes over time. A few centuries ago, most people's lives were characterized by repetitive tasks, long hours of solitude, and a dearth of stimulation. Novelty and change were rare, and people were suspicious of it while being perfectly comfortable with conditions that we would today find extremely tedious. And by extremely tedious, I don't mean as in the time your girlfriend dragged you to a documentary on the life of Al Gore. I mean as in a 60-hour work week spent chipping rough pieces of rock so that they can be stacked to build a structure, or using a hand axe to chop down and trim a 50-foot maple tree, or spending weeks cramped in a stagecoach while traveling from New York to Ohio. Because tedium used to be the norm, the concept of boring, or at least the English word for it, didn't even appear until the Industrial Revolution in the late 18th century. Since then, both the availability of stimulation and our thirst for it have gradually grown, especially in the 20th century, which saw the rise of electricity, radio, television, movies, and new modes of transportation. That not only brought changes in the way we live, it also exposed us to other ways of living, vastly increasing our mobility and the number of new people and places we encountered. Through travel and the media, we could explore not just our own towns and cities, but the entire world. Though in the 20th century we became much more comfortable with novelty and change, that evolution of our attitudes was nothing compared with the transformation wrought by the advances of the past 20 years. By the rise of the internet, email, texting, and social media, and the increased pace of technological change. Our evolving attitude is an adaptation, but it is also a blossoming, for we have always had the potential to make great adjustments. As we'll see, it is in our genes. It is one of our defining traits. We'll get to individual differences later, and to trends that depend on one's genetics, experience, and age. But on the whole, those in the business world who grouse about people's reluctance to adapt to modifications at the workplace are lucky that they don't have to make cats work new hours or raccoons alter the way they forage for food. For compared with other species, humans love novelty and change. We humans jump borders. We push into new territory even when we have resources where we are. Other animals don't do this, says Svante Paabo, director of the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology. So although our current era is making unprecedented demands on us, it's actually just asking us to tap into a quality we've had all along. One of the qualities that make us human. Our ability and desire to adapt, to explore, and to generate new ideas are in fact what this book is all about. Our exploratory drive. Early versions of our species weren't neophilic. 200,000 years ago in Africa, our ancestors had no apparent drive to probe new environments. The crew of Star Trek was on a mission to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before. But a crew with the attitude of the earliest humans would more likely have gone on a mission to sit on a log, take no chances, and timidly avoid areas that no one has checked out. What seems to have changed our psyches was a great catastrophic event, probably related to climate change, that decimated our ranks about 135,000 years ago. At that time, the entire population of the subspecies that we now call human plummeted to just 600. Today, that would be low enough to land us on the endangered species list, finally ensuring that the list contains at least one animal that everyone can agree is worth saving. But though the die-off was no doubt a tragic time for most of our ancestors, it was a blessing for those of our species that survived. Many scientists now believe that the environmental battering acted as a genetic filter, culling from our ranks the less adventurous and preferentially allowing to survive those with a bold desire to explore. In other words, had they lived back then, those friends who always go to the same restaurant and order the steak and potatoes would likely have perished, while the thrill seekers who revel in discovering new chefs and dishes like rotten shark and fried pig's ear would have had a better chance of enduring. Scientists drew this conclusion because for hundreds of thousands of years, humans had remained close to their origins in Africa. But then, as fossils discovered in China and Israel reveal, within a few thousand years of the die-off, the descendants of those hardy survivors or suddenly traveling to distant new worlds. In 2015, those discoveries were bolstered by analysis of both modern populations and ancient genetic material. These indicate that by 50,000 years ago, humans had spread throughout Europe, and by 12,000 years ago, to every corner of the globe. As colonization goes, that was swift, and it suggests an evolution in the fundamental character of our species. Neanderthals, by comparison, were around for hundreds of thousands of years and never spread beyond Europe and Central and Western Asia. If our species was altered by that catastrophic event, if that harsh era of our existence favored those with a greater tendency to explore and take chances, then our attitude towards change should be reflected in our genetic makeup. Our species today ought to possess a gene or set of genes that drives us to be discontented with the status quo, to seek the new and unfamiliar. Science has found just such a gene in 1996. It is called DRD4, for dopamine receptor gene D4, because it affects the way the brain responds to dopamine. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter, one of several protein molecules that neurons use to communicate with one another. It plays an especially important role in the brain's reward system, which I'll talk about in Chapter 3. For now, I will merely point out that the reward system initiates your feelings of desire and pleasure, and dopamine helps carry those signals. Without your reward system, you'd feel the same, whether it's a traffic cop telling you, "I'll let you go this time with just a warning," or a CNN reporter saying, "Scientists have just discovered exoplanet number 4000. The DRD4 gene comes in variants named DRD4-2R, DRD4-3R, etc. Everyone has some form of the gene, but just as height and eye color vary, so does the degree of novelty seeking bestowed by those different forms. Some versions of the gene, such as the DRD4-7R variant, endow people with a particularly high tendency to explore. That's because those with that variant respond more weakly to the dopamine in their reward system. As a result, they require more dopamine to get a rush in their day-to-day life than those with other variants, and seek a higher level of stimulation in order to achieve a satisfying level. The discovery of the role of DRD4 answered some questions, but it raised others. For example, if that gene is truly related to our tendency to explore, do populations that have wandered far from our African origins possess a higher incidence of DRD4-7R than those who strayed less? If our picture of the origin of our novelty-seeking behavior is correct, one would expect that. That expectation proved valid. The geographic connection was made first in 1999, then more definitively in a landmark 2011 paper with the cumbersome title, "Novelty-Seeking DRD4 Polymorphisms Are Associated with Human Migration Distance Out of Africa After Controlling for Neutral Population Gene Structure." Those papers reported that the farther our ancestors migrated from their African roots, the higher the prevalence in that population of the DRD4-7R variant. For example, Jews who migrated to Rome and Germany, a long way from their origin, showed a higher proportion of that variant than those who migrated a shorter distance southward to Ethiopia and Yemen. It's an oversimplification to chalk up anything as complex as a personality trait to a single gene. There are certainly many genes that contribute to a tendency toward novelty and exploration. And the genetic component is only one factor, and in an equation that must also include a person's life history and current circumstances. Still, the genetic contribution can be traced, and scientists are currently seeking other genes that may be involved, and their function, to complete the picture. The good news, as we face increasing novelty and accelerating change in human society, is that although the changes are disruptive, most of us have a good dose of neophilia as part of our genetic inheritance. The same traits that saved us 135,000 years ago can still help us today. Even better news for us and our species is that not only do our genes help us cope with the new society, but our society can also help shape our genes. Cutting-edge research in genomics shows that our traits are not, as previously believed, simple consequences of the DNA that makes up our genes. Instead, our traits also depend on epigenetics, the way cells modify our genomic DNA and the proteins tightly bound to that DNA, in order to turn genes on or off in response to external circumstances. We've only begun to understand how that works, but epigenetic changes can result from your behavior or habits and may even be heritable. If that proves true, the changes in society that favor a greater aptitude for dealing with novelty could eventually cause adaptive changes in our species. Personal R&D and the Neophilia Scale. You may remember that a couple decades ago, a fellow named Timothy Treadwell was a media sensation and a Hollywood darling. Leonardo DiCaprio reportedly contributed to his fundraising entity, as did Pierce Brosnan and corporations like Patagonia. Treadwell was an advocate for Alaskan grizzly bears and a celebrated explorer who lived among them. Psychologists have a term for people on the far end of the novelty-seeking spectrum. They call them sensation seekers. Treadwell was a sensation seeker. Living in Long Beach, California, before he'd ever been to Alaska, he experimented with drugs, such as a speedball of heroin and cocaine that nearly killed him. Another night, tripping on LSD, he jumped off a third-floor balcony and landed on his face, luckily in a soft patch of mud. But after he discovered Alaska and its grizzlies, he traded his drug-soaked quests for adventures in the bear country of Katmai National Park, where he would spend each summer living near the bears and interacting with them. Weighing 1,000 pounds, the bears can run 35 miles per hour and jump 11 feet in the air, Treadwell marveled. They can also stalk their prey in virtual silence and, quote, kill you with one swat, unquote. Treadwell boldly and patiently explored bear behavior until he believed he'd found the secret to disarming them, singing to the bears and telling them he loved them. Animals rule, Timothy conquered. Come here and try to do what I do. You will die here, but I found a way to survive with them, he said. In 2003, not long after making that pronouncement, Treadwell and his girlfriend were both eaten alive. Some like to break 100 driving their Harley down a country road. Others opt for a quiet afternoon, reading a history of the metal lawn chair. Although an extreme proclivity for adventure and exploration may result in a reduced life expectancy for those like Treadwell who possess it, the population's overall chance of survival may be increased by the presence of such pioneers, because the group stands to benefit from their discovery of new resources. And so, our species encompasses a spectrum of individuals, from those fearful of risk to brash adventurers like Treadwell, who seem indifferent to fear. In the wild, novelty-seeking human pioneers explored new terrain or, like Treadwell, the lives of the animals living on it. In the context of how I live today, those who generate unusual and original ideas in science, the arts, or business are motivated by the same kind of drive applied to a different kind of terrain, and the fruits of their efforts are just as influential in our lives in civilized society as they were when we lived in the wild. We also explore in our personal lives, risking time and money on activities that might or might not pay off. It is our individual version of a corporation's R&D. When you socialize with strangers, you are exploring the possibility of new relationships. When you take a night class to learn a skill you haven't tried before, you're exploring a new hobby. When you go to a job interview, even though you are employed, you're exploring a new career move. When you start a new business, you're exploring the world of commerce. When you go on Match.com, you're exploring the landscape of romance. As with other animals, the amount of resources you invest in personal R&D activities depends upon several factors. Your degree of satisfaction with your current environment, your situation in life, and the degree of your innate human propensity to seek the new. Psychologists have developed several inventories to measure a person's novelty-seeking tendency. Included in your PDF is one of them, an 8-statement test that you can take to assess yours. Just rate each statement on a scale of 1 to 5 and compute your total. As the graph included in your PDF illustrates, if your points total 24, you fall in the middle of the population on the Neophilia scale. About 2/3 of all individuals score within 5 points of that, between 19 and 29. I scored 37, which my mother tells me was predictable, given that at age 12 I jumped off the roof of my school just to see how it felt. It felt better a few weeks later which was also when I could walk again. Had I taken the neutrophilia test at age 12, I'd probably have scored even higher, for as the graph in your PDF indicates, the degree to which we are attracted to the new and sensational varies with age. In a study of young adults aged 18 to 26, the average score was several points higher than the adult average, 27.5. And in a study of adolescents aged 13 to 17, the average was 30, 1 point above the cutoff I just quoted, for extreme novelty-seeking adults. Certainly, that younger people exhibit greater neophilia is due in part to the more rapidly changing world they are growing up in. But since novelty-seeking entails risk, this age variation is also no doubt partly due to the fact that, as we'll see later, the rational, risk-avoiding part of a person's brain doesn't fully develop until about the age of 25. While degree of neophilia is an important indicator of your comfort in confronting novelty and change, it is your cognitive style, your manner of drawing conclusions, making decisions, and solving problems, that determines the approach you take when facing the challenges that arise from such situations. Your cognitive style is probably neither purely analytical nor purely elastic, but rather has elements of each. And, within bounds that vary among individuals, the mix that you employ will depend upon the situation, your mood, and other factors. Most important, the approach that your mind tends to adopt can be altered if you work at it. The first step in learning to take charge of your thinking is to understand what it means to think, how elastic thinking differs from analytical thought and programmed processing, what drives our thought processes, and how our brains process information. Those are the topics we will address as we move forward to Part 2. Part 2. How We Think. Chapter 2. What is thought? Peeking inside the skull. Anne Green, a quote, fat, fleshy woman, was escorted to the gallows in Oxford, England, on a cold, rainy day in 1650, still proclaiming her innocence. Doctors supported her claim. They believed that her infant had been born too small to survive, so they doubted that she had purposely caused its death, as was the charge. But the baby's father, who accused her of the crime, was the grandson of a powerful local gentleman, and so the judges sentenced her to hang. She climbed the ladder. A psalm was sung. The noose was fitted around her neck, and she was shoved off the ladder. Anne Green hung in front of the courtyard crowd for a half hour before she was pronounced dead and finally cut down. She was placed in a coffin provided by doctors Thomas Willis and William Petty, physicians who had permission from King Charles I to dissect the bodies of criminals for the purpose of medical research. The coffin was carried to a dissecting room in Petty's house, where the autopsy was to be performed. But when they opened the coffin to remove and cut into the corpse, Petty heard a grumbling in Green's throat. After years of cutting up the dead, this was the first time Petty had heard a corpse protest. He felt her neck and found a faint pulse. The two doctors stood over the body and rubbed the woman's hands and feet for 15 minutes. They dabbed turpentine over the burn on her neck, then tickled the inside of her throat with a feather. Sounds like a Saturday Night Live skit, but it worked. She coughed. The next morning, Anne Green felt alive again. She asked for a beer. A few days later, she was out of bed and, quote, eating chicken wings. The authorities decided to hang her again, revealing themselves to be somewhere between Lord Voldemort and Joseph Mengele on the mercy scale. But Willis and Petty argued that Anne Green's survival was a sign of divine providence indicating her innocence, and Green was eventually set free. She went on to marry and have several more children. Before moving out of Petty's house, Green was able to make some money by returning to her coffin. People paid to file past and gazed at her lying there, the woman who had come back from the threshold of dissection. The incident also conferred fame and prestige on Thomas Willis, who had, quote, brought her back from the dead and let everybody know it. Poets wrote works in his honor, and he became one of the best-known doctors of his time. In his dissections, Willis had focused on the brain. By performing autopsies on patients he had treated throughout their lives, Willis was able to study the connection between brain damage and abnormal behavior. He became the first to connect such behavior to specific changes in brain structure. He coined the term neurology and identified and named many of the regions of the brain that we still study today. He used his newfound fame to publish and publicize his work and his ideas. And with the help from the architect Christopher Wren, he created drawings of the human brain that for the next two centuries were the most accurate available. 300 years after Willis's death, we no longer have to wait until people are dead to look inside their heads. Technology has given us the means to study brains while they are still alive and helped to spawn the new field of cognitive neuroscience, the study of how we think and how that thinking is produced by the brain. It is one of the basic tenets of cognitive neuroscience that the structure and form of thought is independent of its specific content. In other words, the mental activity that leads to the creation of new businesses, shampoos, and meals is fundamentally the same as that which produces new scientific theories, paintings, and symphonies. And so, as we begin to investigate elastic thinking, we are able to consider first, more generally, the nature of thought itself. What qualifies as thought? Why did animals evolve brains? The philosopher Karl Popper addressed this question indirectly when he wrote that, quote, "all life is problem solving." Popper's words reflect the perspective of evolutionary biology, which looks at animals as biological machines seeking to survive and reproduce. In that view, animals are seen as contraptions that navigate from challenge to challenge. The evolution of animal brains, then, is the development over eons of ever better problem-solving machines. Stepping forward with your foot is solving the problem of getting from here to there, but writing a poem or creating a painting is also solving a problem, that of expressing oneself on some subject or feeling. That's a perspective on thinking that is shared by many neuroscientists and psychologists. Whether or not all life is problem-solving, it is hard to dispute that, at least in the animal kingdom, a great deal of it is, because it has to be. A rock resting on a hillside makes no effort to alter its destiny. Plants are alive, but they can't do much better. Being stationary, relative to animals, they have less need to confront change, but also less ability. They lay down roots that more or less determine their environment, and they cope with what that entails, or die. Animals, on the other hand, are built to change their circumstances by moving away from threatening conditions and situations, and toward favorable ones. That is a useful ability, but because their life involves motion, they must continually act to solve various problems and riddles that they encounter. They accomplish that through senses that gather data, or some other means of detecting what is happening in the environment, and a brain, or brain-like structure, that processes the sensory information so that they can interpret dynamic situations and choose the appropriate action. But evolution is economical, and it does not create a Maserati where a motor scooter would do. Hence, to solve their problems, animals possess the three increasingly sophisticated modes of information processing I mentioned earlier, scripted, analytical, and elastic. The former addresses simple and routine problems, while other challenges are met through the latter two. That suggests an interesting question. If an organism is processing information, does that mean it is thinking? Slime mold, a lowly amoeboid, when placed in a maze, will figure out how to propel itself to the food. And if that food is placed at two different sites within the maze, it will reform itself to engulf them both in the most efficient manner possible, by morphing into the shortest shape that can reach both places. The slime mold is solving a problem. Is that thinking? And if we don't call it thinking, why doesn't it qualify? Where do we draw the line? According to the dictionary, to think is to employ one's mind rationally and objectively in evaluating or dealing with a given situation, to consider something as a possible action, choice, etc., to invent or conceive of something. A textbook on neuroscience puts it a bit more technically. Thought is the act of attending to, identifying, and making meaningful responses to stimuli, characterized by the ability to generate strings of ideas, many of which are novel. At their simplest, These definitions say that thinking is evaluating circumstances and making a meaningful response by generating ideas. That means that scripted information processing,